Are we ready to rumble?
Yes. That's right.
In this corner, weighing. So, I know you're tired, right? It's kind of long. This room is not the best vented, right? There's a tendency after the first 5 minutes to drift off. And it's kind of nice because I see it starting to occur. Now, there will be some cool graphics in this part. So maybe, you know, special effects, maybe that will help, right? I'd like to thank a lot of people for this, some of it from NASA, Chandra, ESA, all the different companies that provided links that I'm hooked to as well. So we're going to continue with the cool part of the journey. Last class, last lecture, and by the way, this is your, think about it, your real last lecture. What do we have no thing? Turn off the camera. Right? So we'll have a little thing tomorrow. So again, those of you who got your thumb drive, want to bring your thumb drive tomorrow, bring it and I'll be able to copy the stuff for you. When we last met, we ended up with this story of these people, starting by a guy by the name of Albert Einstein, who rewrote literally the rules for gravity. And it took a while to be assimilated into the physics community, but once it was, different people, from Schwarzschild to Chandrasekhar, put together what they believed were how stellar objects ticked, how they worked. And it incorporated sometimes quantum mechanics and general relativity, and it made some weird, weird predictions. So we've introduced the players. Now I'm going to put it all together and show you what they actually predicted. And I do not want you to believe there are such a thing as black holes. I do not want you to believe there are such things as neutron stars or white dwarfs. I'll just show you what they came up with, and I'll show you what our current evidence is, and see if you actually start to believe what you're seeing. Right? See if it makes sense to you. So. This is what they ended up producing, the life cycle of stars. Okay. So we have a process of stellar genesis, stellar creation. Then we have different paths that stars go through when they live, have a great time, they grow old, and then they bite the bullet. And it's how they die is of interest. And you can kind of see there are different paths, sometimes leading to something called a white dwarf, sometimes some sort of an explosion, and maybe a neutron star, and maybe a black hole. But we'll have a look at this. Of all the stuff that the astronomers came up with, this is probably the most important discovery. This is called the HR diagram, or the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. It relates two things. Literally temperature and brightness, luminosity and temperature. And it allows us to get a picture of where the stars that we observe through our telescopes, just like you did last night, where they spend most of their lifetime. And you'll notice that this kind of this arc right through the middle, and it's just called the main sequence. So most stars spend most of the time sitting there burning their fuel. But we do have little zones, giant, supergiant, white dwarfs, that are off this main sequence. And part of the puzzle was trying to figure this thing out. How do stars get from one point to the other? Do they visit all points? Where do they go? Where do they come from this diagram? Here's a picture of the path for a star that we know and love, mainly our own sun. And as you can see, right now, our sun is sitting right over here on the main sequence. And I've got up here, I've kind of put put together, our sun's age, we're about, it's about middle age, about 4.5 billion years, and how much time it's going to spend at different locations as it runs through that, just to give you an idea of what we've come up with. So you, about 9 billion years on the main sequence. Then what's going to happen, through to a process which we'll talk about, it will slowly swell and come to this area in the red giant process, and it will spend about a billion years. By the way, when we go from here to about here, we have to be off the Earth. Okay? For sure, when it's about the red giant stage, the sun will be so big that it will actually be just inside Earth's orbit. That's how big the sun will be. Right? So we will have hopefully gone and visited another star, and then, well, another star with planets, and stay there. Then it will come down, become a yellow giant, and it swells back up again. It becomes another red supergiant, and ends up swinging across, and ends up in the old folks' home as a white dwarf. And you can see, in 9 billion years main sequence, 1 billion years red giant, 100 billion years yellow giant, and literally 10,000 years of the planetary nebula, and it just sits there and just slowly fades to black. Okay? So this is the path of our star. Each star will have a different path depending upon its mass. So this is all the stuff done by the cosmologists from yesterday. The question normally is how does the sun run? Right? Does it burn coal? Right? How does it get the fuel? And the process that most stars, specifically our own sun, runs off is something called a proton-proton cycle. And there's a nice little animation here showing you how it works. Or those of you who don't like animation, like look at a picture, you can follow your way through. And you'll notice something. In the process of fusion, you get these little neutrinos being kicked out. These are little electron neutrinos. And that was one of the first goals of the Snow Lab that we visited. That big circular sphere that you look through the little tube to have looked down. Right. That their job was to basically figure out why, if the sun only produces electron neutrinos, why are we catching muon and tau neutrinos? What happened? You know, is our understanding of particle physics wrong, or is our understanding of stellar physics wrong? So, proton-proton cycle, and you can see as it works through, we basically go from hydrogen, and you notice how we built up to helium. So, and most of you are familiar with this process from science, how we are fusing and getting energy out of that. There are other cycles. Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, the CNO cycle. And again, some cool animation to show you. And again, the bottom line of all of these cycles that were produced is we get energy out, but it, in doing so, it fuses smaller elements into heavier elements. Now, I've just reminded you that for smaller stars, the proton-proton cycle is more dominant. For larger stars, because they've got a lot more mass and the ability to compress objects, we can get other cycles running. And beyond helium, beyond other cycles, by the way, does anybody know where we stop? Iron? Iron Man, maybe, right? Iron, why iron? Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, you can visualize that curve, right? You sit there, and that's the one thing where it's always good to get energy out, right? And iron's the component. So we don't stop at carbon, we actually stop at iron. So stars will go until, the larger stars will go until we get over the iron. And in case you didn't guess, you could probably read it right there. All right. So that's cool that we've got a burning process, but everybody's interested in the other thing, you know. how do stars die? What process do they undergo? The death of stars. Well, first thing is to know why a star stays a star, like our sun. It's 4.5 billion years old. How does it stay the same size? Because a slight fluctuation could actually damage life on Earth. And it's in an incredible, it's kind of like a nature's natural biofeedback system. We're balancing two things. The thermonuclear reactions, which are taking place in the core, are literally trying to blow the star apart. But the star has enough mass that gravity, and the force of gravity, is trying to compress it. And it ends up being in a stable relationship. If the pressure gets a bit too high, it induces more reactions and it counterbalances, right? So it's a perfect natural statement. Now, it's kind of neat. The light photons that are created here take about 100,000 years to get out in our sun. So when we see light from the photosphere, the outside of our sun, those photons had to journey their way up through the different layers of the sun. It takes about 100,000 years for those photons to make it out. Let's see now. So we're trying to figure this thing out. So I've got a couple of pictures of an atom. And as we've already talked about, we know that an atom consists mostly of empty space. Right? This is, hopefully by this point, you'll recognize that this is cool, but this is more realistic. Right? Now, because it's empty space, as the pressure of the star tries to compress all the atoms together, and within the atoms, it tries to squash down the individual elements, the electrons have a tendency to push back. So you add more pressure, there's going to be a limit to what electrons can do. And we've talked about the Pauli exclusion principle, and the bottom line is, if we have enough pressure, that we can end up just squeezing to this type of a state where we can get two electrons, each shell, one will spin up and the other will spin down. Right? Now, the formulas are kind of neat. Every now and then I'll toss on an equation. These are the equations that this one for sure, came from Chandrasekhar and his understanding how a neutron star became a certain size. Because if you remember the problem that we had with Sir Arthur Eddington is that he said all stars, whatever the mass, ends up this way. Right? Chandrasekhar said, no, dude, well, not quite that way. But he said, there is actually a maximum mass, because when we get beyond that maximum mass, something amazing is going to take place. So we've got stars which are getting more and more massive. The gravity is pushing down, and we end up with this state where the electron degeneracy pressure is actually stopping the star from collapsing. And you can see by the radius, we can actually determine the size of the type of star that we will get. So if you plug in all of these numbers, you can actually determine how big our star is going to be. And it comes out onto the order of 2.7 times 10 to the minus 31 meters. When you plug in that and 10 to the 7 meters, your final answer. Treat n as a constant, right? That's probably the best way of doing it. So we need like the number of particles that we're going to deal with. And so for the certain size of star, we'll put about 6 × 10⁶2/3. So you've got protons, neutrons, and electrons inside there. So we'll take that for a process, but it ends up being that a certain star of a certain mass will collapse to a certain size. Now, that number may not mean anything to you, but what it tells us is that a star like our sun, when it runs, when the pressure and the thermonuclear reactions get out of balance, in other words, it runs out of fuel. When it runs out of fuel and gravity wins and starts compressing it, right, it falls, just like our sun does, right, it does all these little wigglies and zips across the main sequence, it will actually, the core will end up collapsing. And it can only collapse, so it's held up together by the electron degeneracy pressure. So the electrons are in that process. Now, it will happen to stars about 7 solar masses, even stars bigger than our sun, because once it undergoes this process, a star burns the fuel. You know, it burns the fuel from the inside. And as it burns the fuel from the inside, it runs out. It starts burning the fuel from different layers, like onion layer skins, and it keeps burning the fuel from the outside. Then it runs out of fuel there, it burns the next layer, and every time it burns the fuel like that, it pushes the layers above it outward and outward and outward. And that's why it becomes a red giant. Now, at a certain process, once it pushes out the outer surface area, it becomes more diffuse, and there's no more fuel in there, and the only thing that's left is the core, which is under extreme pressure. And the process says that we should have, if the theory was correct, and Chandra was right in the process, that a star like our sun or something under 7 solar masses, right, will swell up. Its horizon will move out. It will basically fade. You'll still have the core of the star left in the center, and the core is not doing any thermonuclear reaction anymore. It is under a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, and so it's radiating a lot of energy and UV rays. And those UV rays should, if the theory is right, excite the gas from that was the outer part of the star. And so we should see, if the theory is right, objects through the best telescopes that you should be able to see some sort of a bright star, very, very dense, very, very hot still, but there should be an envelope around it that was the outer surface that has been blown away, right, and glowing wonderful colors because it's been, just like these like tubes, ionized by the energy still radiating from the core of the star. Okay. So let's look at the properties of these things. So helium is going to be exhausted, the core collapses, density forces electrons to leave their orbits around the atomic nuclei. They should be centers of these things, which I'm going to call planetary nebula, because they should be big, right? Because the outer part of it should be glowing. They should have a mass less than Chandra's, remember Chandra says there's a limit? So the core should be less than 1.4 solar masses. And the size should be relatively small. In fact, the size should be about the size of the Earth. So this is an object, a star, the leftover core of a star. Its mass is 1 to 1.4 times the mass of our sun, but the size is the size of the Earth. That's a star bigger than our sun, the size of the Earth. Here's some pictures. You ask yourself, do these objects follow what we believe we see? Some sort of object in the middle, right? 1.4 solar masses or less, and these ones do. And some sort of visual interpretation of something that has produce a lot of energy and is exciting the out of areas that was once the surface of that star. Now That's my favorite. This one, of course, is from the Hubble telescope. But you can sense the dynamics that take place. So this was based on theory. And this was Chandrasekhar saying that Eddington's concept was wrong and producing mathematics based on his understanding of the general theory of relativity with the concept of the Pauli exclusion principle of embedded quantum, and to make this sort of prediction. So every one of these objects that we see, which are called in planetary nebula, all have a mass that's less than 1.4. The question then, of course, is, well, what happens above 1.4? Okay? So we know the maximum mass of white dwarf is going to be 1.4 solar masses. And instead, above this, Chandra's equations show that the electron degeneracy pressure actually breaks apart. What happens is the electrons become relativistic. The pressure makes them move a lot faster, become relativistic, and when they become relativistic, something amazing is going to happen again. And if you can remember Fritz Zwicky, right? And Walter Bard, right? The process says if this falls down, something amazing is going to occur. Can you feel the suspense? So the question is, what happens if a white dwarf, if the star that produces, we can only produce a white dwarf, what happens if there's more than 1.4 solar masses when electron degeneracy pressure can no longer hold it? What do you think we get? We get a supernova. Ah, nice try though. Nice try. I think the suspense part was that. Yes, we get an event, and I'm showing you some really good, cool mathematical simulations of these events. So we get something called a supernova. So we're taking inside the core. It's slowed down, and the different layers, which is different fuels, right? And it can no longer support itself, and it literally collapses in, then rebounds, and collapses out. Remember, this is all based on theory. So the process is that it can no longer, electron degeneracy pressure can no longer hold, it breaks apart, the star collapses inside, rebounds somehow off the collapsing material, and blows out. So those of you who thought a black hole, not what you thought. Question? No. You could imagine the collapse would be, like, we're talking microseconds for the process of the initial collapsing, right? Can you imagine the electron degeneracy pressure actually breaking down and how rapid that event's going to be? It's going to take a star larger than, you know, 1.5 times larger than our sun, right, and just tear it apart, right? And you notice how much energy was released. So this is the supernova that we've been talking about. And we actually have quite a few satellites whose job is to try to track down the supernova and then relay information to observatories all over the world so that we can track our telescopes to it and try and take pictures of supernova, because we're trying to understand better what happens. So, type 1A, and that was mentioned about a day or so ago. Type 1A is kind of a special type for us. Right? So, we've got a companion, so in this case a two-star system, binary star system. One of them is already a white dwarf. It was small enough, it became a white dwarf, but its companion star has not yet gone through the process. It may be swelling up as a red giant, as you've seen here, and the white dwarf is just sucking in the outer surface of that star. So as you can see, you just follow our way through this little arc I've created. So we get two stars, two normal stars. One of them ages a bit faster than the other, and it's the right size, and it becomes a white dwarf. The other star, over the eons, swells up during its process, but when it swells up, it gets, the outer surface gets closer to the white dwarf, The white dwarf eats it. And what's the maximum mass of the white dwarf? 1.4. So as soon as it gets above 1.4, the electron degeneracy pressure can no longer hold, and it has to collapse and become a supernova, right? So these things are great supernovas, but they're no good for us as black hole cosmologists. They're great for regular astronomers because we basically know that we can use it as what we call a yardstick, a standard yardstick, because we know that every type 1a supernova will explode when its mass is just above 1.4. And because its mass is 1.4 and undergoes a supernova, it should release about the same amount of energy. And therefore, we can tell by the brightness how bright it should be. And if it's dimmer, we can now say it's actually further away. So we use type 1a supernovas to determine how far objects are. So usually these are stars in other galaxies. And we use those because if you can remember Hubble, he used a type of star called a Cepheid variable. But our equipment's not good enough to go beyond our galaxy and check these type of stars. These guys release a big, bright flash of visible light, which we can see coming from other galaxies, stars in other galaxies. So we can actually determine how far these galaxies are based on the luminosity. Okay. So it's a standard candle. And Mark Phillips actually did a lot of work and figured out that it's the area under the curve. It's actually this process. And this is kind of neat. So you can see actual over here. You see a little star over here flaring up. And you can see it follows a specific curve. So if I can get that to go again. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Let's see what we got. So what you'll see, there'll be a little flare right over here. And this will be basically giving you some idea of the data. And the curve matches what we got over here. So get this thing going. So it's just a flare. And that is the process. Now, the nice thing about this is the explosion is relatively instantaneous. But the afterglow, the curve, takes some time. And that was good for us. Because once it goes up, we don't have enough time to put our telescopes on that supernova and then record the how much energy, the brightness, over a period of days, if not weeks, to watch it slowly glow down. And then, and that this picture, right, you can see this one's about 3 months. This curve tells us exactly all supernovas will have that, the same type of curve, and we can determine by the area under the curve exactly how to use it as a standard candle. What we're interested in is a type 2 supernova. Okay. So here's one where the actual star itself, there was no companion star to steal from, the actual star itself, when it ran out of fuel and was going through its process, when the core collapses, that core itself was above 1.4. Okay. This collapse is so catastrophic that the event itself rips apart the star. And the process that we get is that the core that collapsed becomes very, very tiny. Okay. So the process, you want to play that again? Some cool, I tell you, some nice cool graphics, cool animation, right? There we go. So here it is. That just happens to be maybe a Jupiter, just like the one you saw. Gone, right, and of course the animation due to the camera shift makes it look cool, right? And the majority of the star, and what we left is what happens if the electron degeneracy pressure no longer can hold it. What sort of object is that? So death. So remember, we lose a lot of the mass of the star during the actual explosion process. So usually they're just shy of 40 solar masses. It collapses and rebounds, supernova, big explosion, a lot of energy. The electrons, because the pressure is so high that, you remember, the electrons are now they were held in due to electron degeneracy pressure. They're actually now relativistic, and they shoved into the protons. What do you get when you take an electron and shove it into a proton? A neutron. And what else is in the atom prior to that compression? So an atom consists of what three elements? Proton, electrons, and neutrons. Well, if the electrons and the protons are combined to make a neutron, and you already have neutrons there, guess what you're going to get? More neutrons, right? So you're going to get a center core, right? Literally made out of neutrons.
Okay?
Well, usually stars are pretty well neutral. Yeah. You'd probably have leftover electrons, right? but the majority of them become two. So you have a neutron object. Remember, this was all theoretical, right? Think about this. You know, combining this stuff, seeing it work, and the process says, okay, now I have a star greater than 1.4 solar masses, so a star more massive than our sun, maybe twice as massive as sun, but now it's held together not by electron degeneracy pressure, but by neutron degeneracy pressure. So, temperature of this guy, about 1 million degrees. The diameter, about the size of a city. Right. So the density, 10 to the 18, so a sugar cube would weigh about 400 billion tons. And because stars do rotate, right, our sun spins on its own axis, angular momentum must be conserved. So depending how fast the star rotates, this neutron star itself would be spinning, and it could have a rotation that lasts from one day to maybe 1.000 seconds. That's pretty darn fast. Okay. Plus the magnetic fields that the star originally had to be conserved. Right. Now, again, totally theoretical. That's right. That we're building upon theories, Walter Bade, Fritz Ricci, working on what Chandrasekhar had worked with, said this is mathematically what should happen. Now, how are we going to look for a star the size of a city? Right? Nobody thought it was going to be impossible that these things maybe existed. But, yes? Well, the magnetic field was created by the stars themselves first. And so the magnetic field is actually locked into the neutron star. So they're retained by the neutron star. So the magnetic field themselves cannot escape. Because you think about it, you got this magnetic field was rotating with the star. Our sun has huge magnetic fields, right? That's why we get sunspots and coronal mass ejections. That now gets locked into this neutron star. And because the neutron star was once very large, just because it was a star, it all gets compressed inside and gets locked within the process of the neutrons themselves. Now, we totally do not understand the total mechanics of this, right? You can imagine, because you're sitting there, well, you don't need a charge and all this other stuff. Yeah, we haven't figured this thing out yet, right? People are still actively working on trying to understand the dynamics. What's underneath across the neutrons? Are the neutrons flowing like a fluid? Is it like a lot of great questions? People are trying to figure out the dynamics of a neutron star. All we got is the mathematics. We can't build a neutron star to experiment with, right? And so we haven't got all the answers, but all we have is a gut feel of how we believe it should work. Now, in 1968, I'll get to it in a second. 1968, because we thought we would not be able to see these things. Right? It's too small, right? We wouldn't even know where to look. Well, probably try to find a supernova, probably the first guess, right? But we don't know when they're going to go up. So let's have a look. I'll get to your question in a second. In 1968, Bell and Hewish. And it's kind of neat. If you look at this, it's literally almost like chicken wire on poles, and that's exactly what he was trying to do. They were trying to do radio astronomy, right? And nice thing with radio astronomy is you just need any sort of a wire to capture the information. You don't need a fancy dish. You don't need an optical piece of glass. A piece of wire will do. Your car radio does it all the time. And so they were looking at certain things and trying to do astronomy, listening into the radio frequencies. And they ended up hearing, literally, a tick, 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 tick. And this tick, I'm going to slow. It was almost like this. Tick, 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 tick. Right? And they sat there and they said, there's nothing in the universe that can produce ticks that are so rhythmic, so accurate, so precise, that maybe it's coming from E.T. Dun, 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 dun. What physical phenomena could actually produce this rhythmic ticks? And remember, the theory was produced about 30 years prior to this. 30 years prior to this was this theory by Zwicky of this object coming from a huge gravitational collapse based on general relativity that warps and all sorts of stuff. And putting two and two together, they said, well, what happens if this does maintain its magnetic field? And this magnetic field, because the thing is spinning around, and it's almost like a top, and the magnetic field just happens to sweep across the Earth in that direction of our solar system. Whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. That could be the ticking that we're seeing. And we actually give these guys names. These were called pulsars. And they discovered that these pulsars were actually neutron stars whose rotation axis sent one of the magnetic poles in our direction. And the poles were just streaming out, right, magnetic fields and charged particles in our direction that we were picking up through our chicken wire. So they said, no, could this be? Well, we know where this ticking is coming from, right? Because he even though he's doing it in the daytime, right? He says, well, where is it in the sky? Are we actually picking up this ticking? And it came from the crab, it was called the crab pulsar. So we said, okay, let's take our best telescopes and satellites and put this together. And I'm going to show you a nice, incredible sequence of events done through optical, and then I'm going to go to different types of satellites to show you what we believe. Remember, we don't believe yet in neutron stars. We found pulsars, and maybe we think pulsars are neutron stars. But I've told you the story of how we think pulsars or neutron stars came to be. We think it was a leftover remnant of a supernova. So here was the Crab Nebula. It was visually observed, and I think it was in 1054 in China, in some of the Chinese records about that time. Right? They saw, in the daytime, a star that was so bright that it was actually visible in daytime. And their record showed how long it lasted. This is the visiting day star. And so we know the date that this thing took off, and I think it was about 1054. So, and that's a picture of a Crab Nebula. So if we look at it through the telescopes that we have, you wouldn't see it in wonderful color, but you'd see something kind of fuzzy that looked like that in gray and black and white. So let's just zoom in a bit. I'm going to pick this area and just zoom in there. So far, things look kind of messy. Looks like what we'd expect when you take a star and blow it apart. Something interesting looks like in this piece over here. There's a bit of a fuzzy thing over there. So let's lock our telescopes over there. Right. Now, you're a scientist. You don't want to be biased. But what do you think you see there?
Oh, my gosh.
an oh, my gosh? I think I see rings, but I don't want to be biased.
Maybe
aliens. Right? I like eyes. I see something over there, right? Like this. This is the image. Right? You think you see, but you're not sure, right? So, but the nice thing about technology is that technology advanced. You got things called the Hubble, and the Chandra telescope. So we'll take out the ground based ones, and we'll have a break after this. Yeah, and then we'll look and see what they saw. So we'll take that little piece right there. Ooh. Right. And then we take a whole bunch of pictures. Oh, get me there. Whole bunch of pictures and see if I can get this thing going. I think. This is time lapse photographs. So the X-ray will probably be that one, and this will be the normal visual one. Now, tell me if you don't believe that could be exactly what we think. A rotating star, we know the mass, we can kind of sense the size. We're seeing the brightness just due to the heat, and you can sense that it's rippling and generating effects from the object known as the Crab Nebula, which was a supernova. And our theory said that something like this should occur, and this is what our best instruments actually show. And we take pictures over a period of days and stack them together and kind of run them as animation. I think I'm pretty convinced, right? Because how you can't predict when a supernova is going to go off, maybe one per galaxy every 100 years, but here one that took off almost about 1,000 years ago, we've actually been able to use our best technology to zoom in on that, and this is what we get. Yeah, we believe that it's rotating. Remember, this thing is rotating so fast that it's still generating energy outward, and this energy is interacting with the leftover star guts that are just blown apart, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the ripples of the energy make its way through the dust that was once the star on the outside, right? And as these ripples make their way to us, or at least the acoustic, not the acoustic parts, but the charged particle stars, that gets to us, we pick these electromagnetic waves up through our chicken wire. Question? Any object that is under extreme pressure is always going to radiate, right? Because the gravity is still there, trying to squeeze it in there, and there's a lot of kinetic energy taking place and rubbing and friction and processes that we're not fully understand yet, still radiating particles. Maybe not all the neutrons are being, all the protons and electrons are being converted to neutrons yet. Maybe there's some process with the pocket here slowly being converted, but we do know it's still kicking out a lot of energy. Plus, the stuff that was the star, right, it came from a supernova, that stuff is slowly falling back in, and it's experiencing tons of acceleration coming in and kicking out radiation going back out as well. Because if I was falling into a neutron star, I'd be yelling, right? And the same thing is going to happen as well. They're going to be accelerated, and they're going to kick out radiation. They're going to be forced together on the way in and compressed and crushed. So the most obvious question was, what is next?
And you can do it.
All right, so we know neutron stars are held up by neutron degeneracy pressure. Remember, electron degeneracy pressure stops the white dwarf. So white dwarf is the maximum mass of 1.4 solar masses. Neutron stars, this is Oppenheimer's work. Remember, he was working on that. He showed about 3 solar masses. Okay, then above that, not even neutron degeneracy pressure will work. So what happens if a high mass star is so big that the central core is bigger than 3 solar masses? What happens when gravity is stronger than even neutron degeneracy pressure? Oh, can you feel the suspense? How dense can something get? How strong? What if the escape velocity is faster than light? Ah, finally! Ooh. Right. You know, this is cool because a couple of years ago, if I was going to show you a picture or even a bit of an animation of a black hole, it would just be some blue or black sphere in the middle. That would be the black hole. You kind of sense that this thing has more to it than what science fiction writers think. So you've got something here, and there's a slice. You've got things coming up and down, and we were kind of talking about that. And you've got some sort of a disc thing around it. So it's a bit more complicated than we initially thought, which is good because we're trying to make sure that we come up with something that makes sense. Right? Now remember, this object is based upon general relativity. And weird stuff has got to happen with this object. So, birth of a black hole. This is when I put my telescope on high. Let me just get rid of my that fingers kind of. I tell you, nothing but the best here. It needs music. Is it? No, can't be. No. We have ourselves a black hole. Doesn't look black, does it? Looks kind of white. Right? Now, we'll talk about the anatomy in a couple of minutes, but we're looking at the event horizon of a black hole. So, and we've taken a star, three solar masses, at least three solar masses. It's been allowed to collapse through a process just like a supernova, except rather than getting a neutron star, we end up with this strange mathematical object. If you think about it, that strange mathematical object dictated by the Schwarzschild metric, that simple little metric that had two locations where we divided by zero. Remember that? One where there's a certain distance, which we call the Schwarzschild radius, and the other one right at zero. We divide by zero. Right? So what we're looking at is the first location where we divide by zero. All right. If we could eliminate the radiation light, what would it be like to watch a collapsing of a star into a black hole? It'd be cool, like with good animation, but what would it be like to see this thing happen? And remember, it's a supernova, so we don't want to be around there. Okay. So if you watch a star collapse, something amazing would kind of happen. Okay. You'd find that the light emitted from the surface of the star, because remember, it's a star, would be redshifted, and that, i.e., would get field to get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer by a factor of 2 every 20 microseconds per solar mass. So depending on the solar masses, right? And so it would seem to be compacting, seem to get dimmer, but at the same time the surface would seem to freeze. So you see the star collapsing, right? If you remember, got rid of the supernova looking at the core, it would seem to get dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, but slowly, 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 and nearly seem to freeze at the same time, fade to black. Question? This is all calculated. This is all, remember what I'm saying, all I've got here are based on the metric, the Schwarzschild equations, right? And what I've got here, it's not too exciting. You sit there and say, okay, here's, remember, we're getting rid of the supernova, we're pretending we've got a good ship, the USS Enterprise, shields on high, right? And we're watching this, the core collapse, and we just sit there and see this bright white core go redder, dimmer, dimmer, red, almost fade to black, just seem to freeze, right? So it just, and then it would fade to black, you couldn't see it. So you would, you know, it just, like I said, not too exciting. There are equations, and in the sheets I give you, you've got all those equations. You can figure these numbers, but there are nice little formulas that you can determine how long it takes, how dim it gets, and you'll see some of these little things. So that's not too exciting. Okay? How about traveling to a black hole? It's funny, whenever you ask this, you ask this, how many people would like to visit a black hole? How many people would actually volunteer? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 9. You know you're gonna get squashed. So right? Yeah, people still volunteer. And you're right, you know, everybody it's just that process. You're sitting there and say, you know what? That sounds cool. We'll talk about what's gonna happen, you tell me if you can change your mind afterwards. So first of all, as the ship approaches the black hole, right, the variation in gravity along the trip will actually start, it's called tidal force, will actually start stretching and compressing the ship on its way in. Also, it's going to get gravitationally redshifted, and there'll be more redshifted at the end closer to the black hole. So there'll be more red over there. Right? So if I picked my favorite Borg vessel. Anybody here like Star Trek? I say that's good. Those of you over there, you gotta watch it, right? so from outside it looks pretty cool, okay? And what would happen if they were trying to even communicate it? It would be a very interesting conversation because they would be experiencing this time dilation effect due to general relativity. They're getting closer and closer to the mass of the black hole. So their conversations would get slower, 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 right? They would be interesting to hear my conversation because I'd be really fast, right? So it'd be kind of interesting to see what would happen, right? But from them on the inside, right? Besides the ship being crushed by the tidal forces, but we'll assume that they don't notice that, everything would be normal for them, right? Everything would be normal for them. All right, watching a clock, now I had to activate this and I'll see if it works. I'm running off a speaker on my little BC here. I think this will work, we'll find out. Let's begin the experiment, we'll see if you can hear anything. Fading to black. All right. So it gives you an idea of the effect. So if you've got a watch you don't like and it can talk, right? Oh, that's what it was doing. What? Oh, well, all we care about from us is gone, right? The clock inside is still going 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. Now, it depends on the size of the black hole, actually. But if it's a large enough black hole, it would be like me doing this. I'd be going like this, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Well, I'm okay. Are you okay, watch? You're okay. Okay, I'm doing okay. Okay, why am I not hearing it? Captain Kirk, where are you? I can't hear you anymore. But my watch is okay. So for us, for a while, and the caveat is, it depends on the size. We'll see why I'm saying depends on the size. So you wouldn't even know you passed through. The only time you'd really know that something happened is you kind of start looking around. Certain optical effects would take place. But if there's a large enough black hole, it's not like all of a sudden, you're gone. Right? A small black hole, you would be torn apart way out here. Oh, I'll have to show you. I got some more animations coming. There we go. To better understand, let's look at the anatomy of a black hole. All right. First of all, this is the Schwarzschild black hole. This is the one based on that simple little formula, that little equation that we looked at. And it says, literally, there's only two major parts, but I tossed in one more because it's kind of neat to talk about. There's the singularity, That's when R equals zero. That's the second place you divide by zero. That's the right at the bottom. And then you have something called the event horizon. This is made to a green sphere. That's an R equals RS. That's your distance. It's the same as RS. And then that's the first place you divide by zero. And I toss something about 1.5 Schwarzschild radius away, which is called the photon sphere. That's that location where if light was perfect tangential in that spot, it would stay in perfect circular orbit. Perfect stable orbit for light at 1.5. Okay. So, not too exciting. It consists of a location called a photon sphere, which is absolutely nothing. It has a distance location called the event horizon, which is absolutely nothing. And it has a mathematical point, which is absolutely nothing. So a black hole is nothing. And somebody asked the other question, what does nothing weigh? Or what was that question we had on the board or something like that? What's the weight of nothing? Well, now you know, at least three solar masses. So look at the words in here. This is kind of neat. I've emphasized just to have fun here. Within the singularity, matter is infinitely compressed into a region of infinite density. At the singularity, gravity is infinite. Space-time has become infinitely curved. At the present time, science has no tools to describe the conditions within the singularity. All laws of physics lose their meaning in such a reason. Region, we're dividing by zero. At the singularity, space and time cease to exist as we know them, and the laws of physics in them break down. So it's not really possible to envision something with infinite density in zero volume. That's why I say it's absolutely nothing, because that's what happens. It becomes a mathematical point. What's the volume of a mathematical point? Right? Yet it somehow it's encoding that three solar masses worth of mass. Right? That's the cool stuff in here. So there's not a little star inside the core there, right? All the energy of the mass is used to bend space-time. And if you can imagine that embedding diagram, that funnel, with really going down infinite. That's what it's trying to say. The ultimate in bending space-time. That's the singularity. Right? So if you can imagine, here we go. There's the event horizon, and then somehow everything goes down to this mathematical point called a singularity. The photon sphere is that location where photons, if they came in right at that location, 1.5 Schwarzschild radius, it would actually be in perfect orbit. Some cool stuff is happening here. If I could, I could stick my head, I'd have to remember it's a mathematical distance, so I have a very thin head. If I could stick my eyes right in the photon sphere, I could see the back of my head. Because the light in the back of my head go in a straight line, come around and hit my eyes. That'd be cool. And then, oh, marvelous. I just look marvelous. Sorry. Right? Very neat. Now, remember, it's a mathematical point. So we kind of know that light does have a wavelength and it would come in out and extend and so interfere with other things, but it's a location that we deal with. It's kind of neat. Time dilation takes place, right? So again, these formulas are in that sheet, so those you like to play with it. It says if I hovered at 1.00001 times the event horizon circumference, then one day for you would mean about 3 years for the rest of the universe. So time slows down. Right? Isn't that cool? That's the GPS on steroids. If we talk about the difference that takes place on the Earth, right? Now this is cool because you've got this one, and then there's another factor. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. There we go. You get the wavelength problem, but you know what? I want to make some money here. Right? You guys are pretty smart, so I'm going to give you a business idea. Good business idea. I come 10%. That's all I ask. So. You are going to build a time machine, right? Everybody wants a time machine. So this is what you do. Get yourself a rocket ship. Okay. Get yourself a volunteer. insert volunteer inside rocket ship. Send rocket ship to event horizon. Note, do not let rocket ship pass event horizon, else you need a new rocket ship and a new volunteer. Anyway, have the rocket ship go to event horizon. They get very, very close to the event horizon. You could even set up a little pedicure surface. So you could put the toes in there, toenails in there, not the toes. You didn't want to come up with missing toes, but the toenails and like this hair cutting, dip them. Oh, no, some potential, a lot of business opportunities here. They go and visit the event horizon for a small period of time, so maybe a day, so that way they're far enough away, and you can feed them lunch, and they will experience exactly one day. And then when they come back to the rest of the space station, maybe 4 years have passed by. So maybe there was they didn't like a certain government that got elected in the country, and they could just go down for a day and come back, and there's a brand new government. Right? So, like, just think of all the opportunities, right? All that stuff. Question. It's going at its normal rate. Yep. You're going at your normal rate. Oh, a lot faster, right? So yeah, so it's theoretically, yeah, there are some great science fiction people who play with this, and it's possible, right? That if you got large enough, you got close enough, that infinite, like, you could go there, and literally the whole universe could live and die right at the event horizon. But again, theoretically, if you can get to that point, that's what the equations tell us.
So, like,
the closer you get, right, the more different time dilation effects happen. Just like speed of light, where Richard talks about that, the faster you get, the slower, you know, your clock goes as compared to somebody else. So yeah, if you got infinitely closer to the speed of light, you'd have an infinite time dilation. This is a business opportunity. It looks like you're good. So remember, 10%. We'll talk after. All right. Yeah, question. Yeah.
It's
actually like an optical illusion that takes place. We know it does pass through. It's just light has a problem when it gets into close to the event, it can't get out. It's trapped in there. So all we see is it being stretched. Right? So we would actually see it fade to black and literally seem to hover right there. We know the person doing it would actually pass through. We will see them get there. Okay. You like that? Yeah, it literally fade to black. Depending how close you got, the same dilation factor would happen with the wavelength of light. So if you run through the equations, you'll see how dark it really gets. All right. I just wanted to show that we'll run this one again. I said, no matter how powerful your starship gets, once you're at the event horizon, you might as well enjoy the trip. All right. So I'm linking to a site for this. It's kind of neat. So it's almost like a waterfall, isn't it? So you realize you're in trouble, and then you say you're going, like going to Niagara Falls. You realize at a certain point, no matter how hard you row, you're going to go over. So you at a point you sit there and say, well, I might as well go and do it with style. Right? There you go. Yeah, I meant to do that. Right? So you might as well go and enjoy the trip. Right? There we go. Cool. All right. Visiting a black hole. Everybody wants to visit a black hole. All right, take our dude, right? Just let him enjoy. There he goes, fades to black. Now he knows he went right in. There's his buddy, all right? So let's wonder what actually would happen. They're like little lemons just jumping in. Oh, here we go. You know, that was hard to do with PowerPoint. You realize I'm trying to do these things. I'm pushing the limit on what the package can do. All right. Spaghettification is the name of the game. All right. So this basically says that a dude, when they fall in, they experience tidal forces. Now, if you can remember, we talked about Einstein's kind of good thought experiment when he said, I got an elevator and I'm falling in the elevator versus a rocket ship accelerating, I can't tell the difference. And I said the one word very carefully, locally. Because really what happens, if I'm on here, I'm feeling an acceleration straight down. Okay? But really, where is the acceleration vectors pointing? So if I was holding two things here, they're pointing right to the center of the Earth. They're not really straight down, they're at a bit of an angle. And because they're at a bit of an angle, it consists of two vectors, one vertical, one horizontal toward me. So objects will feel a stretching this way, right, just like normal gravity. And so my feet will feel more of a pull than my head. So I will be stretched this way, but the horizontal components will try to squish me in as well. So I would become a spaghetti noodle. That's not too pleasant. For those of you who volunteered, right? This is, you're still going, right? This is what you would experience. And again, nice easy formulas to determine how to calculate the difference in acceleration between your head and your feet. And it's kind of neat. The acceleration is proportional, the change in acceleration, the difference in acceleration is proportional to 1 over the square of the mass of the black hole. So the bigger the black hole, what do you notice about the difference in acceleration? If m gets bigger, it gets smaller. So in fact, if you're going to visit a black hole, visit a large black hole, right? The event horizon will be further out. You remember, no matter how big the event horizon is, as soon as you go in, you're going in, you ain't coming out. But at least you'll be able to enjoy the picture. The trip, you'll be able to sit there, you won't be stretched too far until you get closer and closer to the singularity. It's inevitable, you will become spaghetti one way or the other. But this way, you can at least write a journal or write a novel or a diary out entry. Nobody will read it, I'm sorry. Oh, these guys love this. Yeah. It depends what you want to go through, right? Right? These guys, they know they're going to go, so they want to enjoy the process, right? Okay? Right? And don't worry. Every cosmologist, a lot of them would take the opportunity. So I've got some, you can sense how complicated the mathematics and the simulations if you're writing. So we're getting better at doing simulations. So this is the typical simulation that is done. So this is what happens when you approach a black hole. And you can see three stars here, three stars there. That's actually, these are actually constellations. That's Orion, by the way. The program is actually trying to do a good example, an active example calculations. As you approach in there, you're seeing to see light bending on one way and bending on the other way around the black hole, so you can see multiple images. There's a modern version of this, and I put the website here, and I'm going to see if I can run this. It won't run on here. Actually, I did convert it, but the file was like 1.2 gigabytes running in a flash document. It was like frame, next frame, next frame. So I'm going to see if I can run it I think I'm going to use Real. We'll see what happens here. We'll just see what occurs here, right? And you can see an improved version of that software. It's going to take a while for it to load. Let me just get rid of this. So this is what happens when you get more computing power. And you kind of see this ring, this Einstein ring effect that takes place. Here we go. Now, at some point, we're actually going to cross the event horizon. It's kind of neat. And the question is, you know, can you tell when you crossed it? So we're actually still getting closer and closer and closer. Maybe we're in it. just that last fraction we ended up kind of neat. So you can see the difference in computer graphics, how as our computers get better and better and better at understanding of how it works. And so I give you, I'll give you the website. By the way, in the visit the website, because they actually have clocks, and they can show you the path, and they can actually put put a frame around the event horizon so you can actually see it, and then they'll explain every step of the way here. Question? Yeah. Well, it's a great question. Number one, if you'll notice as you get inside, and I think Richard talked about this, that the whole universe will look compressed and come to the top. In fact, you're seeing everything behind and front in a small process. So does it go to black, or will the light be so intense that that's all you see is because whatever direction you're looking, it's going to look above. So you're just going to see this bright, intense, bright spot, whichever direction you are. Some people still working on trying to understand what they believe is going to happen on that one. You would, well, it be below you would be black, right? Yeah. So, but it's what happens if you look up, right? All right. Oh, let me go back to this dude. Oh, okay. Hang on a second. I got programs galore happening here. You stop that. Everybody's excited. Were you people taping it? Is that what you were moaning? There we go. I think we're about here, right? There we go. So the other thing's still running. By the way, write down the website. Visit it. It's a really... really good website. They've even got, I'm talking about one flavor of black hole. They've actually got animations now showing you different flavors of black holes. I'll talk about the different flavors, right? Okay, get rid of this. This guy just doesn't want to leave, does it? I'm sorry, I have the power. You see this X? Yes. So that's approaching. So and they do a really good job. They've done it's one of the best locations I found that simulates, and you can they got pictures, JPEGs of each step of the way to explain what you're actually seeing, because there's a lot of very interesting mathematics taking place. All right. And just see most pens have got it. Yeah, we'll talk about that. We'll get to those. Like, yeah, like I said, I'm trying to convince you the coolness, the weirdness. Then I have to convince you that these things do exist, right? All right. Orbiting a black hole looking down. There's no fancy pictures for this, but this is what happens if you're orbiting a black hole looking down. You kind of notice stars rotating and rotating one way versus rotating the other. These are all the optical effects predicted by general relativity. Orbiting. Looking horizontal at the photon sphere. So this one you actually see the black because you're right at the photon sphere, right? You see stars going and coming. See this star come and then you watch it go away. There it is. Some very interesting effects. Because the light's coming around and coming back at you, right? Here it comes, there it goes, right? And neat. Looking up, so as you look up, the process would be that you're falling in, it would duplicate and get compressed into a very bright spot, and you can actually calculate how big the radius. If you're ever falling in, there's actually, I give you an equation. You can actually get something to do. If it's a smaller black hole, you know you're going to get spaghettified, something to do. This was kind of cool, and I want to thank Yute Cross for this one. This is kind of neat. This is, you're in a spaceship visiting a black hole, and you got the crew quarters looking front. Looking back, and you've got the cafeteria compartment looking backwards. So you've got three views, sideways, forward, and backwards. And when we're at a distance of 100 Schwarzschild radiuses, this is what the people up front would see. They would see this distortion, which we kind of saw before. People at the side are kind of bored. People at the back are still eating. Let's move it closer. 20. So the people at the front are sitting there thinking, this is not looking too good. People at the side say, hey, this is still a nice view. And people at the back are now working on the dessert. people at the front are sitting there saying, my goodness, maybe we should move to the back. And the people at the side says, there's something happening to my windows. And the people at the back are drinking their tea. The people at the front are sitting there fainted. The people at the side are wondering, oh, we're in big trouble. And the people at the back are having no problem at all because now they're watching TV. At 1.5, swash our radii, right? So the people at the front, and you can see what they're still seeing, nothing. The people at the back were seeing, okay, the stuff and then nothing on this side. And the people at the back are still the people at the back. 1.2, you're starting to see maybe a bit of distortion happening here as we get closer and closer and closer. And then finally when we start getting in there, they're starting to see front, back, and everything at the back. So they're seeing that tunneling effect that takes place at the back. And at the back. And kind of neat. So that's some fun stuff. All right, anatomy summary. So you've got an object that consists of the singularity, which is the thing that location of infinite density, right? Zero volume. You've got this location, which is the event horizon, and you get this location 1.5 of those Schwarzschild radiuses, which is the photon sphere. And we just took the photon sphere just because it's too boring with two things, so we toss on three things. All right? But the question is, this is all the Schwarzschild black hole, right? This is the first billiard-ball solution, okay? Are there other types of black holes? And the question is, I'll try to see the question at the end, so I want to see if I want to get, my goal is to try to get through this before we run out of time, right? Because I got some really cool animations to show you, yeah. So, one of the things is say, what happens if we give a black hole a charge, make it either positive or negative? And one of the most amazing things that occurs is you get the singularity, but you get more than one event horizon. You now get two event horizons. So the Rison-Norton metric actually have three locations where you divide by zero. Now, the more that you have, now I've got over here like a Penrose diagram, more information in the notes. But the cool stuff happens is that if you give it more and more charge, the two horizons get closer and closer together. One moves out, one moves in, and the great stuff happens when they collide, because they collide and annihilate, and as somebody mentioned, you end up with something called a naked singularity. And I'll talk about that a bit further. More realistic is what happens if the star that became a black hole was rotating, right? And this is based on what we call the Kerr solution. And so it says, wow, you thought the charge one was cool, look at this guy. You get two photon spheres, one rotating, one counter-rotating. You get a location, somebody says it looks more like an onion skin, right? Right? You got a location where it's like a boundary where something we call the static area and the ergosphere. So you got a location where that you're not inside the event horizons yet, but if you go inside this mushy part called the ergosphere, right? This it's almost like orange or purple foam or whatever. You cannot stand still. You can still leave. You haven't crossed the event horizon. You can still leave the black hole, but you cannot stay still. No matter how good your engines are, if you think about it, the whole space-time itself is rotating, frame dragging, and you're being dragged along. You cannot stop from moving. You can go up. You can go down into the event horizon and not come out, but you cannot stand still. Again, we have two event horizons. Now, again, just for those of you who like to do some calculations, but the neat stuff is that whenever you cross an event horizon, you may have heard the term time and space swap roles. So when you cross the first event horizon, a normal black hole, time outside goes in one direction. So when you cross inside, you're going one direction, right, to the singularity. Here, when you cross two, it swaps right back. In fact, depending on your axis of approach, it may be impossible to hit the singularity. Now, look at the shape of the singularity here. Something of infinite density, zero volume, and it's the shape of a donut. It's toroidal in nature, like a ring. And it's through this ring that Kip Thorne loves and found some solutions, right? The minus sign. And it becomes maybe a portal, right? A type of bridge, a wormhole between an object called a black hole and another object called a white hole. Perfect. So you may have heard the Einstein-Rosen bridge and that whole concept. Kip Thorne really works on that. So this is the best type of object inside there. So some cool stuff. So very simple, how to make a donut. Take a piece of paper, fold it around, and voila, one donut. And that's a singularity, right? And going through that, all right? So you can see the structure is a lot more complicated, and the mathematics is a lot more complicated. This was not done in one day, right? Remember? Literally within a year, Schwarzschild solution came. It took a while for Kerr to produce this. What happens if you take the Kerr solution and you now give it a charge? You end up with some very unusual objects. Mathematically interesting, but who knows if it's physically reality. We don't expect to have a charged, like nature is naturally neutral in sense when you get an object. We don't expect to be a positive charged star or a negative charge. Yeah, but positive charged star and a negative charged star, it doesn't really make any sense. You never know. But if we do, we know it's going to at least have two event horizons. All right, no hair. What do you mean, no hair? Well, remember we said that Wheeler said a black hole has no hair? Right? Well, I think it's not quite correct in a way, because it has three things that we can deal with, right? And basically what he's saying, that whatever it eats loses its identity. And that comes up to the question that we saw before, what about information? And that was part of the last talk at the end, that they were talking about, where does this information that made a boat, a car, a flower? So we have the no hair theorem. So really it's what I'm trying to say is that we actually have three pieces of information that determines the type of black hole. Its mass, its angular momentum, and its electric charge, right? So stars of all shapes and all sizes end up looking the same. So if you just happen to have a star that looked like this, when it underwent the process, it would literally radiate the bumps away and would become spherical in nature. So in 1916, Schwarzschild produced a solution based on mass, right? It didn't take too long to just add a wee bit of a charge, but when you started spinning the thing around, look how many years this took to come up with another solution to general relativity that added something that was more realistic, a bit of rotation to it. There we go. This is one of the latest mathematical models, computer simulations, of actually falling into. This is one of the most accurate ones. You notice how it's not black? There's a lot of radiation. Right. You can sense where the horizon is. You can sense where the poles, where the jets are. We will cross. And remember, things are falling into it all the time, and they're being yeah, it's kind of neat, are being compressed, so we're just kind of glancing around. This is that you paid for this trip, right? And then what would happen, you're kind of looking at everything becomes bright and focused, and what do we see but maybe just brightness? It's interesting mathematical model. All right, entropy. One of the problems that we had is that information, things falling in, it kind of violated some of the rules, specifically the rules of quantum mechanics. And so one of the things that Stephen Hawking came up with a solution was a way to counteract that. And he came up with this concept of which we can now call Hawking radiation. Have you heard of that? So let's kind of have a look at that. It is tough because there are so many ways to try to explain. Nobody's really got their heads around it to explain it in one way that makes sense. So there are several different ways how to envision how black hole evaporates. Some ways refer to different. Some ways makes no sense at all. I just trying to figure a way that makes sense to you. So this is, if you can kind of think of the concept. The process is that we get these virtual particles, as per quantum mechanics, created and annihilated within a time frame so the universe doesn't really notice it, right? Within Planck's time, right? And so the concept is very simple. What happens if these things are happening all over the place? What happens if these virtual particles, which are being created and annihilated all over the place, happen very close to the event horizon? So close that one of the virtual particles goes in. And if it goes in, it ain't coming out. So its buddy, its life partner, is outside saying, honey, where are you? And they can't answer, of course, because they're inside the event horizon. Now you've got a virtual particle, half a virtual particle, which becomes a real particle, because now it hasn't got the virtual, and it can't combine, and it streams off. And we see these streaming off as real particles. Now, this radiation effect is we're seeing the half that didn't go in seemingly coming from the event horizon, so we see that as the radiation. Now, the best way, the way that I kind of look at that is that you have three situations, and we're only really interested in is this bottom situation right here. And the way to think of it is that it borrowed energy. If you think about this, and again, this is just one explanation. If it borrowed energy to create its virtual pair, and then it wants to get back the energy when they come back together, but they don't come back together, that borrowed energy, which came from the event horizon, will actually make the black hole lose energy, which means it loses mass, which will cause it to evaporate. So you get the one particle going in, the other particle going out, they kind of balance each other out, but it borrowed energy to annihilate themselves in the first place. That borrowed energy is what's taken from the black hole's event horizon. That one makes a bit of sense. Conceptually, it may not be right, because every theory has their own. And the radiation, right, the wavelength that leaves, it will be about 1/4 of the whole black hole's circumference. So the circumference of the event horizon, divide that by 4, and you'll get the wavelength. So initially, right, so if I got a circumference of 35 kilometers, the wavelength will have a wavelength of 9 kilometers long. So the smaller it gets, the smaller the wavelength, and so therefore it will radiate only bright visible light initially when it gets very, very small. The time it takes for a black hole to evaporate, just to give you an idea, don't worry about it, we'll never see it happen, right? It's 10 to the 66 times the mass of the black hole cubed. Age of the universe is just 10 to the 10 years, so don't worry about it. It's one of those things that it's mathematical, but we're not going to see it. Now, a tiny, tiny black hole, right, so the ones that people think that were created in a Large Hadron Collider or whatever, they could occur and evaporate very, very rapidly because they're very small in nature. All right. Even superstring had to come up with a way of explaining how you can get radiation. And this is one of the processes they came up with. You got your little brain over there. You got your little wings coming over, waves coming over. They collide, generate a bubble, and that bubble leaves, and that's what we see is Hawking radiation. So everybody has to try to explain Hawking radiation if it does occur. A lot of people still don't believe it does. All right. Question is, are black holes real? I've given you some of this weird stuff, but are they real? Well, the problem about that is we can't see them. They're literally black, the term, right? But we can see how they affect the environment around it. And one of the ways that it affects typically from a supernova, if you think about that, the leftover guts of the supernova creates an accretion disk which is orbiting the black hole, slowly falling in. As the particles rub across each other as they spiral in, they will generate energy, friction, if you think about that, particles, X-rays. X-rays is a good clue. So we're going to look for a lot of X-rays generated out. So we're going to look for some sort of image, some sort of Doppler effect, or some sort of shift in periodicity that tells us that something is happening. We're either going to watch something spiral in, if we can. Remember, we're not going to be able to see it. We're going to be able to look for a radio signature or something in X-rays that we can see something kind of orbiting one side, orbiting the other side. We'll see a rapid pulse that decreases as it falls in. Right? So here's a bit of another animation. Now, X-rays are not observable from the Earth's surface. So we actually use, to start this process off, old V2 German rockets after World War II to get up there, and we attached a dentist X-ray machine or something like that, and took an X-ray of the sky, and they started noticing things were kind of different. And you can see there's a blob slowly fading away as it falls into the air. So this would be like the accretion disk. This would be a blob, and that's the signal we would pick up. Right? Very neat. Now the most interesting stuff took place is that last night I was pointing to them where the first black hole was. And it was verified by Tom Bolton, who lives in Toronto. And if you can remember the dark matter video, the observatory that we shot the things in, that was the observatory that the first black hole was verified. And if you can kind of visualize the process. You've got an object, in this case another star, right, a 30 solar mass star orbiting something else for a period of 5.6 days. That's a star 30 times this, right, 30 times the mass of a sun orbiting something, right, in 5.6 days. You could see an X-ray source, but you could not see a visible source. And so they do a lot of calculations to determine what is the mass of this unseen object. And you can see the data showing the periodicity of this orbit. And you'll notice that all the mathematics show that it falls within the limits of a, like, if it's a neutron star, we'd see it. White dwarf, we probably, well, it wouldn't even fit a white dwarf, but we would see the object. But we're seeing an X-ray. So an X-ray source, we have another star orbiting it. Something is there. And Stephen Hawking actually made a bet about this being and not being, and he lost this bet. He finally admitted that this Cygnus X1 is the first, X stands for X-ray source. That's why it was located there. That it was, so he accepted. All right, one does not make a black hole, so we got a whole bunch of other binary black holes. And if you notice that all the mass of the unseen X-ray object is all above that critical number 3. Looking for more evidence. As you can sense, as the theoreticians and the cosmologists kind of understood the process, something started happening. We started tossing on these jets, these things on the side. Can I notice that? So let's look for more evidence. Gravitational lensing. You probably know all about gravitational lensing now, right? So an object that can bend light so we can actually see behind it, and you can see the able arcing that takes place over there, and you can see that there's something causing these galaxies, the image of the galaxy, to arc across. So you're seeing it stretched and bent, and that's the process of gravitational lensing. Jets. That's something else that we're going to look for. So it's predicted that they should have jets, right? So you've got an event horizon, there's a singularity, right? Right? And you now they're tossing on these magnetic field lines, for which we call jets. Right? So you see again some animations of showing that how they believe jets. Now this we're getting more and more recent, because 10 years ago, this was not something that they would really consider, understand the dynamics of. But as our telescopes got better and better and better, and we're looking at objects which are X-ray sources, and notice what you're seeing. Right? From these X-ray sources, it looks like jets leaving. Now, some of them seem to be leaving, if you notice, almost like a galaxy. So it leads us to another interesting event. Some more pictures of jets. Probably one of the coolest amount of evidence. Let's look inside. If we saw a jet coming from the core of a galaxy, does that mean that the core of a galaxy contains a black hole? Well, we have our own galaxy. It does have a core. Technology advances now. We can actually cut through the gas. And we're going to take a picture. And lo and behold, we notice that we've got some effects caused by some object that is about 3.7 million solar masses. I'm going to show you some animations as they track these objects. By the way, these things that are moving are stars. This will give you a nice idea. We're just moving closer and closer and closer. And you can see the time frame happening, 1992, 1993. These are actually tracking stars which are moving around. And they're moving around some location that has a big plus sign. So we're looking at a location in a galaxy called Sagittarius A. We're looking at the core of a galaxy, tracking the movement of large stars. And you can see the speed at which these stars are moving. And the only thing that we've got is some sort of an object at that location that weighs 3.7 million solar masses. I don't think it's a white dwarf. Just some more evidence as we start looking at you see the same galaxy looking at different telescopes, different locations, trying to get a feeling of effects that are taking place that are being predicted. As I shift telescopes, you'll notice that I try to give you what each one is trying to do. So I'm trying to show you it's not one system that does it. It's a combination of different systems trying to peek across. So another, looking at strange X-ray sources that are affecting the movements of these objects. So it's not just one object or one galaxy that provides us, you know, a variety of this. This became a very important component. What came first? If the core of all galaxies are these huge, supermassive, million solar mass black holes, what came first, the galaxy or the black hole? Right? And you're sitting there and you're reading this, and one and the other, and now we believe the black holes play a role, critical role in the growth of galaxies. Well, that changed this year. So last year, as people saw this, I had to talk to Albert here, because January this year, right, at the American Astronomical Society meeting, evidence from the Very Large Array Telescope, which is actually a radio telescope, by looking at ratios of galaxies far away in the past, far away, which usually means in the past, this is what the size of the black hole at the center of the galaxy were. They're able to determine that black holes came first rather than a symbiosis. So it was weaving, and then everybody thought that it was actually a mutual symbiosis. And now we've understand, right, based on this, that black holes came first. When black holes collide, you get two black holes, right? A lot of energy, right? And a big black hole. Here's an actual mathematical simulation. The other one was a graphical one, but here's the best, right? And this was presented a couple of years ago. One of the better computers, and they could only basically get about five or so orbits that they were comfortable with the coalition, all right, trying to simulate. This is hard to do. It's easy to draw fancy-looking color things, but to do a real mathematical model that follows all the rules, that's tough to do. Well, the neat thing about that is we do have this occurring. So here's, let's say, some wonderful events, again, some simulations of merging black holes and then merging galaxies. So we're sitting there, two beautiful galaxies merge, like us and Andromeda, each of our black holes. What would happen if their black holes with the accretion disks start orbiting each other? Right, here they go. And you can sense they're going to get faster and faster and faster. Right? But something else, according to general relativity, should occur. Gravitational waves. And this is one thing that we're really looking for. We're trying to look for gravitational waves. Right? This is the most powerful computer animation ever done. This is on NASA's largest computer. This is their version of what should occur. Right? You can see the effects that take place. And these are the waves that we're going to be trying to pick up. Now, it's not an easy thing. How do you pick up gravitational waves if they do actually occur? Right. So, these are the experiments that are underway. So, the race is on. We've got LIGO, Virgo, GEO 600, TAMA, and Auriga. These are different experiments. Plus, we've got one that's going to be launched very soon, and the process of each one of these facilities is actually running to look for gravitational waves. Some of them have oscillating, looking for resonance or contractions within a large beam. Some of them are using interferometers. This is the one that Kip Thorne is really pushing. This is the one that we hope should be launched in a year or so. And I think, this one may have some animation, I can see. No, maybe this one may have some animation. Let's see what happens. We can do it. So let it do its thing and then it happens. So this is the LISA system. Right? So each craft is going to be about 5 million kilometers. They follow Earth's orbit. So there's the three crafts right inside here following the Earth at about 20 degrees. And it's going to be able to detect any strange gravitational anomaly that goes through it. If there's a wave that goes through it, it should oscillate the distances in a specific manner, right? And you can see, there's the size of the detector. There's a penny, just to give you an idea, inside this spacecraft. Set to launch in about 2015, which is in our time frame, not too long away, right? But they're trying to work on the dynamics because they have to keep these spacecraft in perfect sync, right? And the concept is, can we detect these strange waves, gravitational waves that will go through it? If it does, it is probably the biggest little hat in the theory of general relativity, because without a doubt, all of these scenarios are in fact true, all this strangeness that takes place. Sound of a collapse. Right, this is what we should hear as two black holes are collapsing. Right. can you sense it? Remember, each one of these objects is more than three solar masses, and that's the oscillation. Can you imagine how much energy is going to be released on that? These are, get out, I just hit you, stop it. There we go. That was just the expected, what we expected, if we could actually hear the sound of the black holes. So we're looking at basically the visual Doppler shift moved into the audible range to give you an idea of what it would sound like if we could actually hear it. No, no, we haven't got there's no sound. The sound doesn't travel through space. Remember, in space, no one can hear you scream. There we go. Some strange predictions. Gamma ray bursts. Right? Maybe the gamma ray bursts are these colliding black holes. Maybe colliding emerging black holes. Maybe neutron stars to black hole. Maybe neutron star to neutron star. But we believe it's to do with the jet that is appearing that happens to flash across our direction. Gamma ray bursts, black holes. And you can see that in March 2008, that was literally last year, something happened. And we, a huge, in the constellation Bootes, a huge explosion took place, right? Which took place about 7.5 million years ago, but it took that long for the energy to reach us. And you can kind of see the sensors that are picking this thing up. So it's over here, and you can see the counts that are picked up by the receiver that took place, and then the actual image that the telescope was kind of just looking in there, and you can see that little flash over there, right? So it's amazingly dynamical, these effects that take place. Wormholes. I'm speeding up a bit because I've got about 7 minutes. So we got here, yes, there we go. Yeah, a wormhole is a process by, remember we talked about connecting or going through that nice little circular singularity, the donut? And if you are a fan of Kip Thorne and you really like the work that he's trying to do, this is one of the processes that mathematically is allowable. The problem is that we have to create some special type of energy for ourselves to make it work, because we need the throat big enough. So you'd have to carry on your if you wanted to survive this, we had our volunteers. You need your special thermal radiation suit, right? Because we saw a lot of energy being released. Your anti-spaghettification underwear, you always carry that when you go to a black hole. You would have to have this exotic energy in your pockets, right? Because this exotic energy, which has like a negative energy component, will allow the throat of the wormhole to enlarge, because you want to go through it. And the concept is when you do that, you would pop through one side of the universe, and you'd pop out the other side of a universe, not necessarily the universe, right? So personally, I believe it's the fun of mathematics, but everything else was fun of mathematics, and this is some of the interesting predictions from that. Wormhole, the traveler's perspective. So it's the joining, the Einstein-Rosen bridge. Exotic energy is popped in there just to make it more stable and wide enough so you could pass through it. And then you would go in one side and come out the other side. Let's see what we're doing here. Here we go. By the way, do not hit that singularity. Do not. There we go. Yeah. That was the beginning of that, the opening of the throat. You physically cannot see it, right? It's just the opening of the throat. Yeah. It's a white hole, and the white hole, nothing can be stopped from going out of it, of the event horizon. It's just the opposite. Again, I haven't seen anybody just pop out of nowhere in the universe. I haven't seen things just reappear. So, something else. Naked singularities. Yep. Which time? Well, initially the size of the diameter is Planck's size. That's why you need to enlarge it, right? With that special, they created a special negative energy to try to enlarge it. And so it's all mathematical at this point. Okay. So a naked singularity. What happens if you get rid of the event horizon? That's the concept, right? Physics breaks down, and you could see things popping out of that. You name it, things pop up. So all things are possible if you could see a naked singularity, right? Time travel, that could be a path to envision yourself, visualizing time travel, zipping yourself around that singularity that's inside there. You can even, and it's patterned in the process by Penrose and all this fun stuff, you can even generate energy from a black hole. Right? Throw in your garbage. Remember, if it's rotating, nothing stops rotating. Therefore, you can extract energy, build your city around the black hole, dump your garbage inside there, have the ergosphere continue rotating, and hook a device inside there because it's not inside the event horizon. You can have a lot of fun and rotate and generate electricity. Garbage goes in, energy comes out. And then the final thing that they're working on right now is the holographic component, which Richard has already talked to you, and the last speaker also kind of talked about that as well. There we go. So hopefully, I've given you a bit of a introduction, and that's what it's meant to be, an introduction to black holes beyond what you kind of read, to give you a feeling that it's an ongoing process. I've given you the best I could find and the context I have for the graphic simulations, the best in actual pictures to show you that there's something out there. If you believe the black holes, that's your choice, right? But look at the evidence, come up with your own beliefs. There we go, the end.